It's Wednesday, September 13, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a Filipino court dropped the remaining charges against Nobel laureate Maria Ressa, marking maybe the end of her long fight for her and for her publication. We'll talk about that. Student journalists at the University of Florida reject an ad for fear of violating a state law. We'll talk about that law, the staff's response, and the chilling effect that is clearly in place. And Barstool Sports, how it's reportedly circumventing copyright using a, shall we say, creative digital strategy. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with the rhetorical question. When does a journalist stop being a journalist, observing their surroundings, and step in and help, maybe to pick up or lift a car that's trapping a person, or like what so not so hypothetically happened near Tallahassee, when a reporter and photographer covering the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Idalia put down their notebooks and camera and joined a bucket brigade bringing water to a house that was burning down. In this moment, they followed their human instincts and helped where they saw help was needed, contributing in the best way they could.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was just one of those situations where the actual practice of journalism was basically moved aside or shoved aside in order to help try to save someone's home, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is of much more importance than getting the story. And actually, you're able to tell that, still be able to tell that story and the story of what was happening to others in the area. I don't think that there was sort of any, to me, it just didn't appear to be this sort of journalistic lapse or something of that nature in this case. I mean, there are other instances in which journalists have jumped in and
give an example so that we can kind of see that comparison.
Well, I mean, if you're in the middle of, I just remember in one instance when I was covering something similar, where you had, if I remember correctly, it was a storm. There were tornadoes. We were out covering it. There were emergency people already on the ground, and there was no need for me as a journalist or my photographer to step in and do anything. That wasn't the case here. You didn't have the fire engines hadn't gotten there yet. The house was burning. In fact, they along with a whole bunch of others went and discovered that the house was burning, and then they jumped in. So there wasn't anyone else there but them who could have done something. That's a different situation than if you're there covering it and the officials and the first responders are already there doing their jobs. That's a totally different instance.
Yeah, there are lots of examples when journalists go out, and we've talked about this before. In a sense, oftentimes journalists are first responders. So you're on a scene of a disaster or something terrible, and you see somebody who needs water, and you've got a water bottle, of course you're going to give it to them. I mean, you're a human being first. I think we can, you know, we can draw too fine a line about what our journalistic duties are and when do you pick up the camera, when do you put it down. I think we all know that we're there as witnesses for the public, so it's very important for us to do our jobs, but there's no reason you can't put that aside for a minute or two to help a fellow human being.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was that the staff of the paper felt the need to explain their reporters' participation in this, their journalists' participation, that they not only published that story, but took their audience behind the scenes. Is that helpful, or is that making the story about them? Like, is it one of those things where you just do the act you without talking about it? Do you see where I'm going here?
Yeah, I see where you're going. I mean, I think that what it does is that it's a way for journalists or that organization, that media organization, to show that they're not just an organization, they're not just an institution. They're actually people who are a part of an organization, but even more importantly, they're part of the community as well. And they can demonstrate that, and they can show that, hey, we're not just here to document. We also are part of the community. And when the community needs us in a way that's not under some sort of journalistic norm or journalistic practice, we will be there for that too.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think they're also doing it to be transparent. I think it's important when we do step out of our role as journalists that we explain, that we acknowledge that we did that, and that we explain why, because that's what we're about. We insist on transparency from everyone else, so we should be transparent as well.
Okay. We've got some big news to share from the Philippines. Kathy, you weren't here with us last week because you were hosting a luncheon at the National Press Club featuring Nobel laureate Maria Ressa. Some exciting news for her in the last 36 hours.
Yeah, she won she was acquitted on a tax evasion case, which is one of umpteen charges that have been filed against her. We've talked about this, that how people can use. I like the term that one of Maria's lawyers uses. She's a victim of lawfare. In other words, weaponizing civil society against journalists. And one of the things that's happened with Rappler, the organization that Maria founded, is the government there that has wanted to shut Rappler down has hit it with lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. And that has the effect, even if you end up winning, of really draining your bank account because you have to pay those lawyers. So this was a big thing that she won this. She was acquitted on this. There were a number of tax charges filed trying to say that Rappler wasn't paying its taxes. All of those have now been dismissed by the courts, which shows, it's encouraging. It shows there's civil society pushing back against what an autocratic government would like to do. But there still remain some really serious cases against Maria. One of them is this case of quote-unquote cyber libel, an offense that wasn't invented until after she allegedly committed it. And so she and a colleague are charged with that, and that case is still pending. The other one, which is a really serious one, is an effort by the Philippine Securities and Exchange Commission to shut Rappler down. So those still sit out there. And it's like there's always this sort of Damocles hanging over that journalism organization's head. And fortunately, Maria's very outspoken. She's been recognized internationally, and I think that's given her a little bit of a shield. But for other smaller organizations, and we talked about one a couple weeks ago in Wisconsin that get hit with these kind of suits, you really start to wonder, at what point does that cause an editor to say, maybe I shouldn't do that story? So I think what's happening in the Philippines is really important, but I think we shouldn't celebrate too soon because it was a big victory, but it hasn't done away with all the charges yet.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, again, I think Maria's been able to play the long game in this, and because of support that she's received from around the world. Going back to the story that we talked about in Wisconsin a couple of weeks back, those organizations may not be able to do that. They may not have the financial footing. They may not have the popularity or the support that Maria has in this case. And thus, you begin to see where they don't really take the necessary steps to follow through on stories and to make sure that they're exposing wrongdoing because of fear of falling under situations like this where there's lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit and the legal bills pile up, and then they find themselves having to go out of business, not because they're in the wrong, but because they can't afford to continue the fight.
It's a tactic that's being used in place after place around the world. Mm-hmm. It's part of what, you know, I like to call the dictator's handbook. I think the significance, though, of Maria winning and getting the recognition she does is the level of hope that it gives other people. It was interesting to me, we had, after Maria's speech, we hosted a discussion with journalists in exile, and it was really gratifying how many of them came up to me after the event and said how meaningful it was to them to be in the same room with other journalists in exile, but also to be in the same room as Maria Ressa, who really is a beacon of hope for so many people who are under the kind of pressure you're talking about.
I really do. I think the entire event last week was very important, because what's happening to journalists around the world, and journalism as a profession, it's under attack, and it's under attack regardless of whether you're talking about a dictatorship, such as what's happening in Russia, or you're talking about what's happening domestically in terms of what happens to journalists when they expose some wrongdoing and then they get caught in the partisan political divide that we're in now, and the institution itself finds itself under attack, constantly trying to defend its right to actually expose the wrongdoing on all sides.
And in some cases, it isn't even necessarily wrongdoing. Right. I think about the Wisconsin case you both have brought up, and I just want to refresh some people's memories in case they weren't here with us. It was because a reporter went and reported on some discriminatory and homophobic comments that were made in a public meeting by a government official. So in that case in Wisconsin, the person reported truth of something that was said and done in an open public space. And that person was either upset that it got reported or embarrassed that it got reported.
Probably both.
And that, well, okay. But I don't want to assume intention there. So I'm just kind of giving some options. But that was the reason for the lawsuit, that it truly is for little more than to intimidate.
Right. But that goes to the point, though.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to refresh everyone's memories. I'm playing moderator for a second.
Those are the types of things that Maria and her staff have been doing for years.
Yes.
It wasn't that they were reporting, they were reporting corruption and wrongdoing, but they were also reporting on some of the everyday things that the government was doing that they didn't particularly like. And now they've found themselves year after year after year having to fight these lawsuits.
Yeah, and it's a huge drain financially. It takes away, as the editor of the Wisconsin paper observed, it takes away resources that you otherwise might want to devote to reporting. So I think this is just something to keep an eye on. It's, I highly recommend Maria's speech. It's on YouTube. Google Maria Ressa National Press Club. And because the significance of this for most of our audience who are not reporters is this is an attack on democracy. Mm-hmm. And Maria very, very eloquently explains that. You'll come away alarmed, and I think people should be.
So while we're talking about, Kathy, I'm going to use your words, taking that page from the dictator's handbook. We're going to talk about Vladimir Putin and his government for a second. The Wall Street Journal, reporting this week that there may be a little bit of possible movement in efforts to release Evan Gershkovich. That coming from an idea that the Russians are looking for a potential prisoner swap for a guy being held in a German prison.
Yeah, it was interesting. Evan Gershkovich's parents were at the National Press Club for Maria's speech and had a private meeting with her. And so there were people from the Wall Street Journal there. And really what I was hearing was the U.S. has no one to trade. And so it will have to come from a third country. So that, I think, is what people are looking at. Clearly, that was the aim all along by Vladimir Putin. He's going to take a journalist and try to swap. And it's a really difficult situation because another person who was at that meeting was Jason Rezaian, who was held hostage in Iran. And the point that he made is there are now whole swaths of the globe where we have no eyes. Because if you're a news organization, are you going to send a reporter into a place where he or she might be kidnapped? And then you go through, it's been months for Evan Gershkovich. And so, I think this is another way that dictators try to silence and blind the press.
And also get something out of it, because if they can foster a trade, then they get someone back because they've taken these types of actions. And that sort of extends the chilling effect
Yes, because it puts a really, it makes for editors who are deciding what parts of the world do we cover.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It makes it very difficult.
So as we're talking about chilling effects, I want to talk about one that is really taking hold at the student media level here in the United States, specifically student journalists who run the independent newspaper The Alligator at the University of Florida. The paper's general manager denied the placement of an ad for a mail order abortion pill. The message from the editorial board indicates the decision was made without its knowledge by the general manager, but that three lawyers were consulted, all of them indicating the Alligator could have faced legal action if they ran the ad in violation of Florida Statute 797.02, which states that knowingly advertising, publishing, or distributing materials that could provide information about obtaining substances to assist for inducing miscarriage is a first degree misdemeanor. So there was a lot of reaction to this decision on social media, especially among alumni circles. And much of their criticism was that this paper, the editors of the paper, the staff of the paper, wasn't standing up to the government and taking the ad. But an ad is very different than running a story that's reported in its pages.
Yeah, I mean, I have served as a board member of a college newspaper, so I can well imagine the arguments and the angst that went into this, because you'd be accepting money for an advertisement that, it's from the language you read, could clearly, somebody could come after the newspaper. And your responsibility, if you're on the business side of the paper or you are a fiduciary in any way, like if you're a trustee, you want to make sure that paper lives to fight another day. And so you have to say, again, like we were talking, how much is this potential lawsuit worth it? And clearly the decision was made no. On the other hand, the paper wrote a story about it.
And they're going to continue to write stories about it, yeah.
You know, and so it's not like people don't know that this happened. So I think they probably handled it as well as they could. They protected themselves financially from a potentially really, fatal lawsuit. And they made this known to the public so the public can opine on it. But again, being transparent. But I think it's a very difficult situation for the paper because of the language there. And the language is pretty intimidating.
It is. And you can read the full language on our links blog. I did provide a link to that full statute. In some ways, though, the potential advertiser, they're still getting their message out there because we're talking about it.
They're getting free advertising, if anything. Exactly. They're getting free advertising. I mean, the other thing here, too, which in many ways hamstrings the publication, at least the business side of it, mm-hmm. is that this case is in court. But there hasn't been any kind of temporary restraining order against the state for implementing it. I think if that had been the case, then they probably would have been able to go ahead and accept the ad. And it's one of a string of these types of laws that have been instituted in the state of Florida. And so to me, I think part of the problem here is, again, this is that whole First Amendment argument again that we've been talking about for a long time. Are these laws infringing upon the First Amendment rights of this publication and others to be able to basically take whatever ads mm-hmm. they want to within reason? And that's, to me, that's part of the problem here. Again, and it's also, are you restricting commerce as a part of this law, and why are you doing
that?
Interstate commerce,
because
absolutely. Yeah.
This is about mail order of a prescription drug,
and this drug is manufactured nationally. So you have this state law, which is basically telling you you can't advertise in our state. And if someone accepts the advertising, then they're going to be violating the law. I mean, again, I'm sitting here going, why has there not been a temporary restraining order, especially if this case is already in the courts?
Well, I think, again, this gets to...
It may be about needing the test case, yeah. But go ahead.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, but this is the kind of case that newspapers used to fight because, but this was back in the day when they had deeper pockets.
Right.
But newspapers used to say, bring it on, and the newspapers would be the ones bringing the case. Remember, New York Times v. Sullivan was about an ad.
Right, absolutely.
It was, and that's what set our standards, our very high bar for libel against public servants. But that was about an advertisement. And I think in those, back then, you had newspapers who were bringing suits to open up public records, to expand their ability to watchdog public officials. But now, you know, what's the Florida Alligators going to take on bringing a lawsuit?
Well, and there's another layer to that, too, that I'm just thinking about as you're mentioning New York versus Sullivan, right? That was New York versus Sullivan. This is not a commercial entity. This is not a private entity. This is like maybe this isn't the test case because it is an independent student newspaper associated with a state university, which means it is actually a function of the state of Florida.
Well, not really, because it's an independent. The newspaper itself is independent.
Okay.
It has an affiliation with it, yeah. But it is independent of the University of Florida. So they operate outside of the academic aspects of it or the institution itself. But I think you make a very good point. Who's going to be there to back them up?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they have the funding? Do they have the finances to be able to fight the state of Florida? And what the state of Florida is banking on in passing laws like this is that the institutions that they're going after are not going to put up a fight. And so this law is there. And I mean, this is basically what's happening all over the state, whether you're talking about abortion or whether you're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, mm-hmm. or gun rights. Go across the board. The state of Florida is banking on you not being able, or whoever, whatever institution is, you're not going to fight us in court. And if you do, we will fight you and fight you and fight you, and we'll prolong it. And while we're doing that, we're going to create this chilling effect where you're not going to be able to operate in the way in which you want to.
Okay, well, stop me if you've heard this one before. Someone on X, formerly known as Twitter, is using the platform to engage in business practices that might be, well, not quite on the up and up. This time we're talking about Barstool Sports. Never heard of it? Don't feel bad. It's a digital media company that produces a lot of sports and pop culture content with an eye towards fantasy projections and gambling, most of which is directed at millennial and Gen Z men. Some call it edgy and fun. Some call it a bit over the top. Its own owner has called much of the site's topics as, these are his words, sports smut. Well, the Daily Beast reported this week that Barstool has developed a culture of stealing materials from content creators and reposting them without attribution, extending the copyright practice to sports clips. And how they're doing this is by creating a network of dozens of fake Twitter accounts, posting this copyrighted stuff, and then embedding those tweets, embedding that content into their own.
Well,
it's a creative way around copyright law.
It is not
in a good way.
Right. It is creative, but it is, I think, ultimately, now here's a case where somebody's going to have the pockets deep enough to bring a suit, because I would not be messing around with the sports networks whose content you're stealing. And so it's interesting. I wonder how long this has been operating before it was outed, but now the idea that there's a systemic effort to post this stuff as supposedly anonymous tweets that then you can pick up, that is going to catch the attention of the ESPNs, the Athletics, the ABCs, the CBS Sports, all of that.
And the leagues.
Yeah. Yes, very good point, because they're all operating their own news content as well. And so I think, yeah, I think this is just, well, let's see. What time is it? The lawsuit should be coming up at any moment.
Okay. Well, before we go, I have to hand it to our social media manager, Nate Brown. He sent me this breaking news late yesterday afternoon, just as I was finishing up getting the show together, and I went and added this story to it. The Nashville Tennessean is hiring a new reporter to cover, wait for it, Taylor Swift. Now, on the face of it, my first thought was, what, a Taylor Swift beat reporter? But in Nashville, it's an addition that kind of sort of makes sense.
Yeah, well, okay, I could see where creating this beat, maybe even if the beat is temporary, I could see where this makes sense. The issue I have is not with the coverage or who you're covering and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. It's the fact that you have a Gannett-owned newspaper mm-hmm. that is creating a beat mm-hmm. to cover a worldwide phenomena, while at the same time it is laying off reporters in droves.
Okay.
And that's the problem. And these are reporters who are covering the environment. They were covering
the Tallahassee paper that we were talking about at the beginning of this show was actually a Gannett paper
right,
as well.
Right. So, I mean, they're covering issues that have a direct impact on people on a daily basis. That, I mean, we're talking about issues that really affect them, and we don't have enough reporters covering those issues, but we're going to create a beat to cover Taylor Swift worldwide phenomenon.
So let me play. Let me bring another idea to this. Okay. Taylor Swift is having a tremendous economic impact.
Okay.
We have talked about Taylor Swift and how she is re-recording. Albums, and I can tell you, I can probably name one Taylor Swift song. So I'm not a Swifty. I'm just trying to look at this. How she's re-recording albums from times where her creative license was taken from her. We've got the impact locally, nationally, internationally on what her concerts are drawing in. I will say there has been, at least in my opinion, there has been a lot of really valid criticism that if news organizations that were giving into the Taylor hype this summer were not reacting and covering Beyonce 10 days later as Beyonce was following in town, that there was a real issue there and how they were covering the stories. I still see the Taylor Swift phenomenon as being a lot more nuanced than this popular teeny bopper musician.
Well, Taylor Swift is certainly important in Nashville, but I sort of see it, having worked for a Gannett paper myself,
okay.
I see this as really an effort which will ultimately be futile to get access. Why do you cover a beat? You know, you cover a beat, so you get to know the mayor, you get to know the city council, and you have to balance the access issue with this stuff that you don't want to pull a punch on a good story. But I think here it's like, is Taylor Swift really going to open her doors to a reporter? So what's the point?
Unless she opens her doors to one reporter and the 200 and some odd plus newspapers within Gannett all benefit. That music means we're out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about what we talked about on our Links blog. It's under the Podcasts and Programs tab at KBIA. You can also download the podcast there or subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. We're on Facebook and we're on X, formerly known as Twitter. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll talk about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, to Takiya Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and like I said, Nate Brown is our social media manager.